Blog Talk Radio.
I'm not chilled out at all here. Hello and welcome. This is Progressive News Network Extra with Brooke Hines. I'm Brooke Hines, your host. What a couple of days it's been. We'll see. There was the debate on Tuesday. It's Thursday now. Thursday, January 16. The Iowa caucus is only 17 days away. That's three more days than 2 weeks. Caucuses on February the 3rd. And, you know, things since last weekend, you know, since about Saturday, Sunday, stuff has just been wild. Stuff has been a little keyed up, you might say. I just read some really interesting stuff. I want you to know, though, we've got Victor Tiffany tonight at 7:30. He is the author of Bernie or Bust. Wanted to get his take on some of this stuff that came out of the debates, and I wanted to see, you know, what he thinks about it and where we're at and stuff. So we're going to talk to Victor at 7:30. Before that, though, I just wanted to share, I wanted to come on a little bit early and share just a few thoughts, some news, some things I came across today. Something that is just really sticking in my craw is that Warren isn't running any ads in New Hampshire. Have you guys seen this? So Warren goes on this huge offensive this weekend against Bernie Sanders and, you know, makes all of this noise at the debate. And it turns out that she isn't even running ads in New Hampshire. And, you know, New Hampshire being right next door to Massachusetts, a lot of people have said, well, you know, that's where, you know, if she's going to pick up some early support, it's going to be in New Hampshire. It's definitely not going to be in South Carolina. She does have some ability perhaps to pull off some support in Iowa because Oklahoma is, she's from Oklahoma, she's white, Iowans are white, blah, 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 so on and so forth. But to hear that Elizabeth Warren is not running ads in New Hampshire just blows my mind. That is, that's really telling. That tells me that all this stuff she's done for the last few days, you know, starting with the Alex Thompson allegations, you know, with the volunteer script, which turned into Alex Thompson parroting out the rest of this mess with the Bernie told me I shouldn't run, or Bernie was sexist or wasn't adequately woke enough when I said I wanted to run, or when we met, or whatever it was. We don't know because she won't talk about it. You know, right there pushing all of that was Politico's own campaign reporter, who's assigned to Elizabeth Warren, I guess, Alex Thompson. So he tweets out today, he tweets this gloating tweet about how, you know, ha-ha, you Bernie people, all of this stuff has accrued to the benefit of Joe Biden. He's the one who's really appreciating this. And, you know, immediately everyone was like, yeah, we know, and you started it, so, you know, what gives? You know, like he was tweeting it out like, oh, here's something that no one has ever thought of. And, you know, turns out everyone except the political reporter had clearly thought of that. You know, we're under the impression that people who run the world are smarter than we are. We're under the impression that they've got their shit together, and it's a freaking lie. The world is held together with scotch tape and staples, if we're lucky. Yeah, there's enough scotch tape to cover things over. And it's not the smartest people in the room. It is the people who got to the head of the line. And how do you get to the head of the line? By being assholes. So the world is being run by assholes who have taped everything together and with scotch tape and staples. Now, it really is a worst case scenario. I'm actually surprised we're all still alive on this spinning on this planet. And you know, it just keeps getting more and more interesting every single day. I want to remind everybody too, we have a good show for you coming up on Sunday. I was just talking to our esteemed producer, Rick Spizak, earlier today. I will be running the show on Sunday. He's got an event that he's going to be attending, and he's lined up a couple of really good interviews. So he's got a great organizer from Tampa Bay area, Kofi. People in Florida all know Kofi. I know Kofi and I can't remember his last name, so there you go. But Kofi's going to be on, and Dennis Campbell, our friend from Liverpool, is also going to be with us. So that's going to be interesting. Janine Maloff is also, she just filed her intent to talk about the imperial presidency and the urgent need to end the imperial presidency. You know, this as we've got impeachment happening. It's happening, people. Really good show on Sunday. Don't forget to tune in for that. And real quick, I'm going to run through these other items on my list before we bring in Victor. Interesting story. Representative Katie Porter from California's 45th was at Elizabeth Warren events this weekend giving away claws out nail polish. This is nail polish that's brand is claws out. Like if you're a cat and you're going to give them the claw, claws. At events this weekend, before or as all of this stuff was starting to hit the fan, Elizabeth Warren's allies and friends at her own events were handing out this promotional, gimmicky thing that was like, ha ha, isn't this funny? Claws out, we're going to scratch everybody up. Yay! That should give you a little bit of sense of what's going on in the mind of the party people. I'm also seeing opinion writers today taking this particular tack. Rebecca Traister did a piece today pushing the idea that it doesn't matter if Bernie had said whatever to Elizabeth Warren regarding, whether it's difficult for a woman to run or whether he thought a woman should run or not, whatever he's being accused of right now. None of that matters because it's so difficult for women to run for president, and there's a history of women not running for president. So with given all that, it just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what was said, which is just the worst argument ever. It's not even an argument. I don't even know what to call that. Here's the piece. Whether Mr. Sanders did or didn't say what Ms. Warren remembers him saying is beside the point, writes Rebecca Traister, which is that there are quote, complicated, painful, difficult dynamics that have kept women from the presidency for the country's entire history. Well, you know, for the early history, the politics weren't that complicated. It was, are you a white guy who owns land? It was very uncomplicated. Things are more complicated now. I think that they get even more complicated with this kind of crap going on. This is actually making it harder for women. Elizabeth Warren is actually making it harder for women right now at this point. This is exactly the kind of behavior that, comparing her run and this manufactured dust up with her and Bernie, comparing that, you know, to the Me Too movement, trying to accrue some some credibility, some victimhood credibility by being victim adjacent somehow or something. We're supposed to feel bad for Elizabeth Warren. I don't know. I'm none of this is making any sense to me at this point. You know, like maybe the first couple of times I heard it, I thought, okay, this is a political line of thinking that I've heard before, and maybe it makes a little sense. But it's really started to empty out of anything meaningful for me, because Elizabeth Warren has not come forward to talk about it. She just threw it out there and then said, oh, no, it's not anything I want to address now. And has left not just Bernie Sanders and Bernie Sanders supporters twisting in the wind, but if you think about it, she's left the entire Democratic Party twisting in the wind. This is not something that you would do if you were interested in the health and well-being of the Democratic Party. This is not something that you would do, just throw a bomb in the middle of everything and then walk away and say, oh, I can't talk about that now. That would be untoward. That would be, nobody should do that. Here, have some claws out nail polish. Elizabeth Warren she's done. She's done. This is not the kind of thing that the politicians, the politicos can take forward and broaden their career out of. This is the kind of thing that you retreat with and you spend the next 6 months or a year trying to fix. She's not going to win voters with this. She is not going to improve her political standing in Massachusetts as a senator with this. And she's already one of the least liked senators in the Senate. Massachusetts is supposed to be friendly to these kind of quote unquote liberal politicians. So, you know, I don't understand how it is that somebody who's this unliked, not well liked, somebody not this well unliked. I don't understand how somebody not this well unliked survives this, comes back from this. She's going to need a tour, a fence mending tour after this. I've talked about this a little bit before. Elizabeth Warren was somebody that in the early 2000s, when her Two Income Trap book came out, she was somebody that I really, really liked and really looked up to. I loved that book. I used it as a Bible that helped me understand why it was that, you know, my family couldn't afford to actually be a family, you know, that we couldn't actually do the things that we were supposed to be doing as adults, adulting in an adult world. That book helped me understand it. One of the things that I kind of missed in the book, though, that was pointed out to me today, is that Elizabeth Warren makes the case in the book. She's making this anti big government case in the book. She's really doing this libertarian kind of two-step with it, while at one point she's saying, you know, on the one hand, she's saying families with two incomes can't get ahead because the things that are the costs that are fixed, like housing and education and healthcare, those items keep getting more expensive while wages are flat. And that was really true in the early 2000s, right? And it's even more true now, okay? And so part of the argument she was making in that book is very conservative. Part of the argument that she was making is it makes sense for one parent to stay home, probably the one who likes to cook. And I don't know who that might be. Maybe it's the woman, maybe it's the guy, you know, in a woman-guy relationships, whatever. But somebody needs to stay home, and the person who stays home gets to, you know, look after the kid, because that's going to save you on childcare, and that's going to save you on, she brought up things like dry cleaning and eating out, and it was like all of this, you know, doing all of these budgets for families that have kids and dual incomes and all of the little miscellaneous costs that are involved in making ends meet. And, you know, at the time I was amenable to looking the other way with regard to her political backbone, because she was the only one out there saying it. She was the only one out there who was actually speaking the truth that was the truth that I was experiencing. So, you know, that was real important to me. It breaks my heart. It breaks my heart that she is turned out to be this person. And I'm not alone in this. Michael Moore, who just launched a fabulous podcast, Michael Moore did a piece on this whole thing yesterday. I think it dropped yesterday. I'm looking for it right now. And I listened to the whole thing this morning, and it brought all of these memories back to me. Okay, his podcast is called Rumble. And the episode is, it's episode 19. He didn't just launch this. It's been around a while. Episode 19, The Sad Downfall of Elizabeth Warren. Michael Moore shares his personal history with both Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. Elizabeth Warren starred in a Capitalism, a Love Story. Anyway, Michael Moore goes into, you can hear his voice cracking. You can hear that this is really emotional to him, that Elizabeth Warren is somebody that he admired and who he trusted. And of course, Bernie Sanders is somebody that he very much admires and very much trusts. And this whole thing is like, been a nuclear bomb, like right in the middle of all of this social glue that used to hold us all together. And why anybody would do this 17 days before the Iowa caucuses is completely beyond me. Now, let's break this down a little bit. This is the Democratic primary, the Iowa caucuses. If anybody's to benefit from this, here's my guess. I think that Bernie's going to benefit from this. We've already seen that his fundraising numbers went up, and we've already seen, a big move of people who had donated to Elizabeth Warren retrieving those donations through ActiveBlue. Which, by the way, if you've donated to Elizabeth Warren and you're not feeling good about that now, you can use your ID number and go find those donations on the ActiveBlue interface, the user interface, and you can retrieve those donations. They will refund them to you. So that is very good to know. And a lot of people have been doing this. So, you know, I think that this was transparent, and I think that Bernie Sanders is going to benefit from this some. But I think that what it was meant to do was it was meant to benefit Joe Biden. Because if you go back to the debate, you know, Joe Biden had the least amount of talking time of anyone except for Steyer. He wasn't pressed on any issue. He pretty much got away with just, you know, barely having a heartbeat on stage and, you know, just making it through. And he's on purpose, he's very purposefully avoiding the media so that he avoids making gaffes. Now, this is going to be more difficult as impeachment continues and senators who are in the presidential race are going to be engaged in impeachment. That's really just going to leave a, you know, there's Buttigieg, there's House Member Gabbard, there's Joe Biden, there's, you know, quite a few people who are in the Senate who are running for president. They're going to be otherwise engaged with impeachment. So all of that is bad news. I think that what, and I don't know if I mentioned this yesterday, but I think that what we saw here was Elizabeth Warren has staff from Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016. She also accrued some staff from Kamala Harris's campaign when Kamala dropped out. These guys are the worst of the worst in terms of, you know, politics as blood sport. And this to me reeks of exactly the kind of thing that I would expect from Hillary Clinton staffers, you know, people who listen to the likes of David Brock and apparently the likes of Blue State Digital. And this is the kind of politics that they sell. This is the kind of strategy and the kind of consulting that they sell. There was a really interesting, this is going to be the last thing that I talk about before I bring on Victor, because I just thought that this was so freaking awesome. I know that a lot of our listeners also listen to or watch Jimmy Dore. And Jimmy Dore did a show yesterday, or day before yesterday. And it was quite a long segment, but for a piece of it, they looked at the exchange between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders at the end of the debate. Now, for about a day, we didn't know what was said there. For about a day, we just had the visual of Bernie Sanders offering his hand to shake Elizabeth Warren's. She refuses it. Words are said. Bernie Sanders shakes his hands and walks away. Now we know what was actually said there. So we've, you know, that's all been filled in. But without even knowing what was going on there, our Jimmy Dore, the always amazing Jimmy Dore, completely called it. This guy is spot on. So let me make sure the volume
she
is up.
Tries to catch him flat-footed because he's not expecting her to attack him again right to his face, which is what I think she's doing. This is all.
He says Elizabeth Warren is trying to catch him flat-footed, that Elizabeth Warren walked up to Bernie Sanders to attack him, and he wasn't expecting it. And this is like the oldest mean girl trick in the book, y'all. And anybody who's worked in politics knows that those mics were hot. He knew they were hot. She knew they were hot. She went over there trying to continue getting a gotcha on him. So I'm going to continue. I'm going to, it's just 18 seconds.
So she comes over and says, hey, why are your supporters coming at me? Hey, why are you saying I lied? She comes at him. And Bernie's like, what?
So she comes at him, you know, why did you lie? And with the intent of putting him, you know, back on his heels so that he might say something stupid while there's a mic on. And, you know, it didn't work. It absolutely didn't work. Now we know exactly what was said during that exchange. They were able to isolate, I guess using space age technology, isolate the vocals in the mics by turning them on. And so we know exactly what was said there. And without playing the piece, this is the transcript. Elizabeth says, quote, I think you called me a liar on national TV. And Bernie Sanders says, what? And she says, I think you called me a liar on national TV, she repeated. Bernie Sanders says, you know, let's not do this right now. If you want to have this discussion, we'll have that discussion. And then Warren replies, anytime. And then Sanders says, you called me a liar. You called me a liar. You told me, all right, let's not do it now. So he started to kind of wind up. He actually stood up for himself, which I think is great. I mean, you know, like all of this Quaker-ish, you know, turning the other cheek, that's fine and good and everything. But as I had to remind my husband yesterday, does anybody in the world remember Al Gore? Remember Al Gore? Okay, like he's not the most progressive, wonderful candidate in the world, but he kept turning the other cheek. He kept imagining that all of the attacks against him were beneath him. It was beneath contempt, that you just don't answer that, that that's uncouth, that it'd be, you know, that you just don't answer disingenuous attacks. And I really believe that that's part of what did him, because it made him look weak and it made him look like he didn't have a good answer for things. And it actually made him look like he was a liar when he wasn't. There's a lot wrong with Al Gore, for God's sakes, all kinds of things wrong with Al Gore. But this one thing where he didn't defend himself repeatedly and he needed to defend himself repeatedly is one of the things that really, really hurt him in 2000. And I don't want to see Bernie Sanders making that same mistake now. And might be on the brink of doing that. He might be teed up for being a little too generous with, you know, people who are attacking him. You cannot let bullies get away with stuff. You have got to hit back. And I'll tell you one other thing. I'm about to bring on Victor. I'll tell you one other thing. All of the people out there who are saying that Bernie's supporters being active online with regard to standing up for him and trying to correct the record and so on and so forth. They want to shut you down. They want you to think that what you're doing is in some way harming Bernie Sanders. And it's not. You know, it might be different if Bernie Sanders was out there standing up for himself and pushing back affirmatively and firmly and, you know, without question, but he's not doing that. And so that leaves it to his surrogates and to his supporters to fill in that vacuum. I'm more than happy to do my little part. And I know that there's plenty of other Bernie supporters as well who are happy to do that. But I do want to see Bernie stand at a step up pretty soon here and you know, help himself out. Not too much, not too much. We don't want him to get in any trouble over, you know, standing up for himself, because we actually do have quite a bit, you know, we actually can carry quite a bit of this load back here. That's, you know, not complaining about that. But he does need to push back in that way that Bernie Sanders is very good at. When he decides to push back, it happens and it's unassailable. And so that's what I would like to see him do. Okay, we have Victor. Give me just a second. We're going to do a little bumper music right here, and we're going to bring Bernie or Bust, Victor, Tiffany on in just a second. All right. Do we have you there, Victor?
We do. Hi, Brooke. How you doing?
I'm great. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Can't complain.
It doesn't do much good anyway. That's what I keep hearing.
That's right. Yeah, it doesn't.
I've been keeping up with the Bernie or Bust television on YouTube. Is that something that you're working on, or is that all Alan's stuff, Alan Kit Howell?
Yeah, he's with the Revolt Against Plutocracy Committee. I listen to it every day. And I just have to say, sometimes I can finish his sentences for him. He and I are so much in sync in terms of our thinking about grubby populism and all the rest of his terminology that he uses. I really appreciate his approach toward things.
And he's a prolific poster. So you guys are getting videos up almost every day.
Yes, every day he does a show. Can't recommend it enough to people. He did a show today, or was it yesterday, on this kerfuffle between Warren and Bernie. I find it fascinating. Was it Michael Moore you were quoting who said, why does she do it now? Why would she do something like this? We think, Alan and I believe, that she's not in this to win the election, to win the nomination. She's in this to divide the left and make sure Bernie doesn't win it. She's part of the establishment. She's, as you pointed out, she's got Clinton staffers working with her. She consults with Hillary Clinton. Her project, her goal, is to make sure Bernie's political revolution fails. So why would she do it now? Because the Iowa caucuses are a few days away, and the debate was this week. So that's why a conversation from a year ago was conveyed from her point of view, whether what was actually said in that conversation between Sanders and Warren, we don't know, right? I have a theory of truth. They may both be telling the truth. They may both believe they are telling the truth and that the other person is lying, because she may have misunderstood something he said. Maybe he said something that was just taken wrong, or maybe he didn't quite say something as accurately as he intended to. We don't know because we weren't there. But that really matters much less than why did she bring it out now? What is the attempt here? And the attempt is to sabotage Bernie Sanders. That's her mission. That's her goal. That's what she's out to do. She's not going to get this nomination. And if she did, Donald Trump would be reelected. Not because she's a woman. And this is something I really want to focus on, again, just for a couple minutes, because we talked about it last time I was on your podcast.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of Sanders supporters in 2016 who voted directly for Trump. About 1.5 million of Sanders supporters voted directly for Trump, which caused Clinton to lose Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. And she and polls from 2019 indicate that the same number of people are going to do it again. If Bernie's not the nominee, they're going to vote for Trump again. So she didn't help her case at all. As you said during your monologue, she did not help her case at all with this attack. It was not suited well. It wasn't framed to help her. It was framed to hurt him. And, you know, as you pointed out, his donations rocketed up during that 24-hour period. So she didn't even do that very well. And he managed the very embarrassing lack of handshake. I mean, that was just really poor sportsmanship on her part. She just – I just don't think she's trying to win. I just don't see this as a maneuver that is designed – or intended to help her in the polls. She's going after him, which is why this conversation from her perspective or the lies she's telling, I'm not convinced she is lying, as I said, but whatever was said in that conversation was conveyed to the media in the lead up to this debate, specifically to have CNN address this debate. And Abby Phillips asked these questions so deceitfully, even Glenn Beck, the master of dishonest questions, took her to task, or CNN to task, for this whole line of questioning. Because he's, been, of course, been talking about CNN not being accurate from his right-wing perspective for a long time. But even he called CNN out. And, of course, so did Matt Taibbi in his article, CNN's debate performance was villainous and shameful. That's my problem, more than Warren, is CNN. The way CNN is framed so much of this debate to go after Bernie Sanders. CNN, MSNBC, New York Times, and the Washington Post are part of the establishment media, and they do not want Bernie Sanders to win the nomination. And what that amounts to, they don't know this yet. They don't understand this yet. They refuse to cover these Sanders-Trump swing voters, and so does a whole bunch of other media. You and Slow Newsday, so far, the only podcast willing to actually have me on to describe these swing voters. They're older Bernie supporters, they're whiter Bernie supporters, and they are more conservative Sanders supporters. They remind me of Reagan Democrats. But at any rate, when you sabotage Bernie Sanders, whether you're the media or you're Elizabeth Warren, all you're doing is setting up Donald Trump to win re-election. Because Bernie Sanders, largely because of these swing voters, and largely because of his political revolution, his theory of coalition building, he is the only candidate who can defeat Trump under current economic conditions. And Alan has been stressing that, you know, every time he says Bernie's the only one who can defeat Trump, he always says in current economic conditions. And the reason he and I are stressing that conditional certainty is because of the history, post-World War II history, of presidents running for re-election. Every president running for re-election with unemployment this low is won re-election, every one of them. So anybody who thinks Donald Trump, this revolting, disgusting plutocrat, is going to be easy to beat is repeating the mistakes of 2016, the thinking that he's, you know, a pushover, thinking that he's going to be underestimating Donald Trump. I could go into other candidates and other reasons here, but there's no question Bernie's the only one positioned right now who can defeat Trump in November.
Let me unpack a piece about CNN, and then I want to I want to get you to talk a little bit more about this swing voter demographic, and we'll go into that in some depth because I find that fascinating. I was reminded of this article earlier today, and this was reported in February of last year, so almost a year ago, that CNN hires a GOP operative with no journalism experience to coordinate its 2020 election coverage. So this operative, this GOP strategist or operative, Sarah Eisger, came from, get this, she worked for a variety of right-wing organizations and campaigns, including Carly Fiorina and Mitt Romney presidential bids and the Ted Cruz Senate campaign. And so she comes to with no experience in journalism. She's put in this position of coordinating primary election right now, coordinating election coverage. And she had most recently come, as a matter of fact, from Jeff Sessions' Department of Justice. She was public affairs. She was his public affairs officer. So this doesn't seem like the most, this is not a journalism move. This is CNN a year ago signaling the kind of election coverage that they were going to do. And in keeping that in mind, when you were talking about the swing voters, I know these swing voters you're talking about. I know about this demographic. I lived in Upper East Tennessee and in places that were emptied out by NAFTA, in towns that used to have these vibrant economies where you could graduate high school and go to work for a factory and have a boat and sport around on the TVA lakes on the weekends and just pretty much have a decent life. And all of that's gone. It's amazing how bad things are up there. And I hear from my friends how popular Bernie Sanders is in the first district of Tennessee, which is Upper East Tennessee. This is hill country. These are the mountains. And I don't think people appreciate this. I don't think they appreciate how Bernie won Montana. He won Michigan. He's won all of these blue collar states in 2016. So tell us a little bit more about these swing voters, and you know, we'll tie this back in at some point to how and why CNN is then just missing the boat, because they need to be talking to these voters too if they think that they're, you know, wanting to court conservatives. But yeah, who are these guys?
Well, first thing I want to stress is they're not unique to Bernie Sanders. In fact, there were far more Obama-Trump voters that the media has no problem talking about. They'll talk about the Obama-Trump voters, but nobody wants to talk about these Sanders-Trump voters who were maybe – I just don't understand. Sam Cedar actually talked about them because Norman Ornstein tweeted about them back in December, and Sam came back on his show and talked about that tweet, and he accused Norman of weaponizing these people. And I sat there shaking my head thinking, Sam, you don't get it. They are the weapon. They're Bernie's weapon. But Bernie can't deploy these people. He can't come out and say, hey, if you don't nominate me, my supporters are going to help elect Donald Trump. That just isn't going to come across well. So it's got to be the media to talk about these people. And for whatever reason, the media refuses to describe these people, to discuss these people. Now, let's go back to 2008. Because, again, there's a long tradition of this kind of party disloyalty for one reason or another. And it's not always rational. So that's one point I want to make. 9% of the people, Democrats, who voted for Obama in the primaries in 2008 voted for John McCain. All right, so it might be emotional, which swing voting. It might be propaganda that you know, makes these persuadable voters swing to the other party. In the case of Clinton in 2008, 25% of her supporters voted for John McCain. And that was coordinated. That was, they had a pact. They had a slogan, party unity my ass. They were the three or busters of their day.
Pumas.
And the reason Obama still got elected is because in 2008, the economy was falling apart. The stock market had crashed, and unemployment was starting to skyrocket. So this big mass of swing voters, independent swing voters, switched from red to blue, and all those party unity my ass Clinton supporters had no effect because Obama was saved by the great block of independent swing voters. One thing we know about these independent swing voters, before I come back to the Sanders-Trump swing voters, independent voters support Bernie Sanders more than they support Biden, Warren, or anyone else. So if anybody's thinking about electability, there's that to take into consideration when it comes to who to support. But back to these 2016 swing voters. There were 8.5 million Obama-Trump voters. Swing voters, 8.5 million, 76% of them approved of Donald Trump's handling of the presidency. 76% approval rating from those swing voters. That leaves 24% who will come back and support Biden or Bernie. And that's what we don't know. There's no polling that's been done on that percentage of people because – If they were to tell pollsters, yeah, I'll come back if Biden's the nominee but not Bernie, then the Bernie-Trump swing voters will be outnumbered. But at that point, the Bernie or busters will kick in. Numerically, the Bernie or busters combined with the Sanders-Trump swing voters represents something very close to the total number, the 24% of Obama-Trump swing voters who are not satisfied with Trump's presidency and who probably will vote blue, probably blue no matter who. All right? Mm-hmm. So if you think about that, you can do math figuring out, you know, if they vote for Biden, then you've got those votes will be subtracted by the Bernie-Trump swing voters and the Bernie or Bust voters, and it's going to be very, very close, everything else being equal from 2016. Or if they come, or if you nominate Bernie Sanders, you don't have to do that math. They will combine with the Sanders-Trump swing voters and the Bernie or busters, and Bernie will have the most amount of party unity possible, with the possible exception of Warren supporters. What's going to happen to Warren supporters in the aftermath of this? What happens? What are they going to do? Every one of these candidates, I need one more point about these swing voters. Every one of these candidates has swing voters like this. Buttigieg has 7% of his supporters won't necessarily support the nominee. Warren, 20% of her supporters won't necessarily support the nominee. Biden, 23% of his supporters may swing. We know the Wall Streeters, of course, are going to go with Sanders. He'll support his super PACs, and they'd rather have a neo-fascist in the White House than either Warren or Bernie Sanders, and that shouldn't be surprising. So if Bernie is the nominee, what's going to happen to those swing voters? And that's why I think we need to be very careful about too much antagonism between Warren and Bernie, because mathematically, he may look at this very difficult challenge of defeating an incumbent president with the economic winds at his back. If the stock market crashes, he doesn't have to take this into consideration. If he wins the nomination and the stock market crashes, you know, he doesn't have to worry about who he picks. But that's a very narrow window there, because about as soon as he wins the nomination, he starts thinking about, or candidates start thinking about, who their VP is going to be. But let's taking the, let's assume that the stock market doesn't crash and everything is about the same as it is now, which makes the election very, very close. And maybe even Bernie Sanders can't defeat Trump. But if anyone can, it's Bernie. And he may have to have Elizabeth Warren as his vice president choice, mathematically, if he's going to truly unite the party and get his her supporters on the Bernie train. It's possible to unify the Democratic Party. He's going to have to, it's possible he may have to bring Warren on as his vice president nominee. Now, she did an awful lot in that debate to undermine that possibility. And by the way,
yeah,
she's
I
not
think
my first
that,
choice. Barbara Lee would be my first choice.
Yeah, I think I would agree. Barbara Lee would be a great choice. But I don't see, after all of this happened and the way that it's unfolded, I don't see that being credible that Bernie would or his people would allow him to float Elizabeth Warren out there or put Elizabeth Warren on a ticket with him. I think that this really took that off the table, which to be honest, was something that that's probably the worst part of this for me, is that my biggest compromise concession that I can imagine this cycle is being okay with a Warren, this is in the past tense, would have been being okay with a Warren Bernie ticket with Bernie at the top. And after this attack and the way that it's unfolded, I just don't see how that could happen. So I think that's been taken off the table. And I also feel like Elizabeth Warren has taken herself off the table in terms of being someone that people can trust that they're
right,
dealing with.
Bernie.
She's ruined her brand. So, yeah, and I was kind of like, you know, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders ticket, unbeatable. Bernie Sanders, Barbara Boxer, not Barbara Boxer, who you just brought up, Barbara Lee.
Lee, yeah.
That would be a beautiful ticket. I wanted to bring up, though, there's this Emerson polling. This is December polling. They're asking these questions a little bit differently. You're talking about swing voters, and that's got a specific definition. There's this Emerson poll. Luke Savage tweeted this out today, and it had some real interesting numbers. And so here's the percentage of Democratic candidates supporters who would back Trump against any of the other three if their preferred choice didn't secure the nomination. So you've got Buttigieg, Warren, Biden, and Sanders. And the question basically is, how many of your supporters would vote for Trump if you didn't secure the nomination? And Bernie Sanders had the lowest percentage of supporters who would actually back Trump. His was 4%. Buttigieg's was 12% of Buttigieg's supporters would back Trump. 10%, more than twice, 10% of Warren supporters would back Trump. And again, more than twice, Biden supporters would back Trump by 9%. So
yeah, would you share that with me, because that's a fascinating poll. It goes against a lot of what we've been looking at.
And I think it's the way that the question is asked. And so I struggled with how to present this, because the way that it's like the way that they've chopped the numbers up here is totally legit, but it's coming at it backwards. It's kind of, or sideways. It's coming at it from a way that we're not used to seeing it. And so you got to be careful about how you talk about it. And there's a difference between percentages and points and all of that. But what's cool about this poll is that it's totally on, you can click on the link in Luke Savage's tweet and that'll take you to the whole thing. Top lines, it'll download it to your Excel so you get all the tabs and, well, enough tabs.
Yeah,
I'm sure you're not getting all of them.
The Emerson polls get fascinating. When you look at those tabs and you scan out to the right side of the spreadsheet, that's where you start seeing the, you know, if your candidate's not the first choice, what will be your second choice, and that kind of questioning. So yeah, if you'd share that link with me, I'd appreciate it. Either the tweet or the Emerson.
Yes. Okay. And this question is a little bit more about second choice. We've switched our language about swing voters a little bit more towards this ranked choice voting model, where we talk about second choice. You know, who's your first choice? Who's your second choice? Whereas years ago, a couple of cycles ago, we always talked about swing voters, which is that's not asking who your second choice is. It's, you know, coming at it from a different direction. So I think that we're catching two different kind of people in these numbers.
Could be. And ranked choice voting would go a long ways toward ending that kind of party disloyalty, because you're more likely to get the candidate you want or someone close to the candidate you want, rather than say someone like Joe Biden, the Hillary Clinton of 2020. It's interesting that, you know, Biden's selling himself on electability, and he's just probably the least electable of everyone who was on that stage. He's still riding Obama's coattails, but he's very low energy, and Trump is going to crush him on that point. He supports the Trans-Pacific Partnership, another place where he's just not going to get support in those deindustrialized states like that Tennessee county you were talking about earlier. And he's got this problem with Ukraine. There's no question that his son was working for $50,000 a month for a corrupt Ukraine energy company with no energy knowledge. And Biden very outwardly and explicitly bragged about getting the prosecutor who was looking into that company fired. I mean, this is, that set of facts aren't in dispute. So Trump is going to confuse the whole Ukraine question around if Biden's the nominee, and voters are going to go, well, they're all corrupt, right? And either not vote. And there was an awful lot of that. I just saw another stat today about Wisconsin, because a congressman, I can't remember his name, endorsed Bernie. And he talked about how Trump took Wisconsin by 23,000 votes. So you talk about these swing voters. There's another whole set of voters who also were responsible for Trump's victory, and that's registered Democrats who didn't vote at all. A quarter million registered Democrats in Wisconsin did not vote for anyone. They just didn't come out and vote, period. That's another thing that no one's going to come out and get excited about Joe Biden. He's not generating excitement. He's not filling stadiums. He reminds me, again, of Hillary Clinton. Bernie's filling stadiums. Bernie excites people. And if you're going to take on a president who excites his base, there's no question about it, he's got a lot of enthusiastic supporters out there, you're going to have someone who's also got a lot of enthusiastic supporters. You're going to need an army to take on the president's army. There's no question about that.
And it's funny because, you know, when I talk to party people, what I hear is that, and I hear this a lot, is, oh, Bernie better bring his voters with him that that aren't regular Democratic Party voters. You know, he better bring his people with him, or else he's, you know, dead to us or something. And you don't hear anything like, you know, when's Biden going to actually, like, you know, turn up the gas and actually bring people out? You never hear that. It's just assumed that the performance you see from Biden, or the performance you see from, you know, whatever centrist middle of the road candidate, it's just assumed that they're the benchmark. When over here you've got Bernie Sanders filling stadiums and registering all these new people to vote. You know, here's a very, just to this point, a very interesting statistic. How many times has Biden ran for president? Is it like 2.5 or 3 times? Like he dropped out one time. He's never won delegates because he never got over 15%. Bernie Sanders earned 1,415 delegates in 2016. So he has a more proven record of putting delegates on the board for sure, just in one election, than Biden has in 2.5 or however many presidential elections he's run. And every time he's run a presidential election, it's always just been, he seems like the stoned guy who sits in the back of the class. Like, why is this guy here? Oh, to crack a joke or two, or to be silly Joe Biden. He never brought anything to the presidential, the prior presidential Democratic primary campaigns that was substantial. It was all comic relief.
At best. And he had to drop out once because he plagiarized somebody in one of his speeches or something. I don't know the details, but he plagiarized somebody. He's not, his integrity is questionable. And he's also one of those people who's not really fully honest. Like, you need, if you're going to go after Trump as a pathological liar, you got to do it with somebody who's fundamentally honest. And again, that's one of Bernie's strengths. I want to talk about one of the sleazy questions that Abby Phillips asked during the debate. It has to do with, you know, first of all, her statistic, I don't know where she pulled that from other than perhaps her rectum, that 2/3 of Americans won't vote for a socialist. That it's not a great number, but it's not that bad either. And
here's something that Bernie didn't talk about, which is the people who don't vote.
Can you talk into your mic? We're losing you. Hey Victor. Hey Victor, we're losing you. Can you talk into your microphone? Hey, Victor.
That information alone doesn't necessarily mean.
I don't think he can hear me.
He won mayor, his first election, the mayor of Burlington, by personally activating those people. They get them to register.
Okay. Hold. All right, I'm having to mute Victor for a second. I'm going to see if I can bring him back in and get his sound worked out a little bit. And I don't think that he realizes that his sound has gone out. Often this happens when people are on Bluetooth headsets. It's just one of the technical deals that we have to deal with these days. I'm a big fan of wired headsets, So let's see if we got him back. Victor? Hey, Victor. Hey. Yeah, he can't hear me, and I wish I could turn him up enough so that you guys can hear him and kind of run this on my side. Let me try one more time. See if this works. One more time. All right. Sorry, guys. This is what we're going to do. I am going to get him to call back in. And we'll fix that in just a second. Because this was getting ready to be very interesting. And this is something that we need to talk about. You know, demographics are super important, and how we think about groups of voters is super important in terms of numbers, you know, just in terms of, you know, turning people out to vote. And of course, this is the argument that's given to us by the party as to why we should never have ideology and why we should never, you know, complain about anything. But the fact of the matter is, as we'll talk, you know, as we all often talk about on the left, is that the reason why you see that that independents are a larger party than either Democrats or Republicans, the reason why people are leaving the traditional political parties is because there's issues of the quality of engagement and whether people are being represented and whether or not our interests are being heard in a manner that makes any kind of sense. The swing voters thing is, and I know a lot of our listeners are way younger. And back during the Reagan years, when Reagan was elected, he was elected by a coalition of working class, blue collar Democrats who were mostly Midwest, upper Midwest. In fact, there's a county in Michigan, I think, that is considered the bellwether county for Reagan Democrats. And it became an article of faith. People projected all of this other kind of ideology onto these so-called Reagan Democrats. They projected this other ideology that, oh, they're racist, or they don't care about identity issues, as we knew identity issues back then. They're just kind of knuckle dragging this and that. And maybe that's not the case. Maybe people vote their economic interests or the material interests a lot more than we give them credit for. We lost your audio callback. Still trying to get Victor back in. And I think that the stat that I brought up on the Emerson poll is a little bit different, because the question being asked there is, percentage of Democratic voters, percentage of Democratic candidates supporters who would back Trump against one of the other three if their preferred choice didn't secure the nomination. And so Buttigieg is saying that He's got 12% of his supporters who are saying that, yeah, I'd back Trump if one of the other three of my preferred choices didn't secure the nomination. Yeah, I'd support Trump. So when you see these numbers and the bigger numbers, these bigger numbers mean, hey, yeah, we'd support Trump. Bernie Sanders is way down there at 4%. Now, maybe, just maybe, this doesn't have anything to do with all of those, you know, ideas of those ideologies that are associated with liberals, the way it's understood on MSNBC to be like, you know, woke liberals and this and that. You know, maybe that's not what's at issue here. Maybe the Buttigieg people are more inclined to vote for Trump because they think that Trump would represent their material interests, so forth and so on, Warren and Biden. And I think we got Victor back. Yay.
Yeah, I agree with that. These aren't swing voters because of some higher strategy like party unity, my ass, or Bernie or bust. These are people who, just looking at the situation, see, you know, the Trump economy as their next second best bet.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And we're so not used to talking in terms of material interests. It's funny, too, because, you know, business news is completely devoted to, you know, the viewership responding to the material interests of capitalists and very rich people as if they were our own interests. But when it comes to our own material interests, we're expected to put that aside and care about, like, only identity, as if identity is the only way that we represent ourselves or are the only ways that we interact with the world, which I find really bizarre, because most of the time, as Americans, what we're doing is we're driving around and we're going to the grocery store and we're getting our kids from school and we're doing all of this, you know, capitalist exchange. It's one exchange after another. We're mired in economic activity, and yet we're expected to be, you know, operating out of whether or not I'm a woman, or whether or not I'm a woman who's a certain age or race or ethnicity. And I don't know. Maybe it's not just one thing, which I think is what you're saying.
Yeah, it almost seems like it's this relationship between identity politics and neoliberalism has been planned, right? So the neoliberals know that their priorities are toward the market and toward what the interest for transnational corporations or broad, large national corporations want and need. And therefore, a lot of people are going to get screwed. So they focus our attentions on identity. Right? What, you're Bernie or bust. You must hate black people, or you must hate the people that Trump's putting in prisons, or, you know, keeping in cages, or some crazy thing like that. Instead of understanding that there's a broad working class rejection of the Democratic Party establishment. And that includes Buttigieg and obviously Biden and Elizabeth Warren. The Democratic Party has lost enough of the working class, and if they can't win elections. And so,
right,
that's another way of saying, if they want to defeat Trump, they have to nominate Bernie Sanders. There's no choice in that for them. A Bernie or bust. There's just not enough Bernie or busters to have that kind of impact. But the working class, the Obama Trump voters and the Sanders Trump voters, those are the ones. Those swing voters have already made up their mind. So if they want to defeat Trump, they have to abide by this minority of Democrats these swing Democrats, which sounds anti-democratic. Wait, why do we have to do what the minority wants? The majority wants Biden, or the majority wants Warren. Why do we have to put up with what the minority wants? And the answer is because they're the ones that decide who wins the election, right? It's not the majority who wins. It's not the dyed-in-the-wool conservative or the dyed-in-the-wool liberal who decides the outcome of elections. They're kind of set and positioned. It's the swing voters that decide elections. So if you want the swing voters, the working class swing voters who are leaving the Democratic Party to vote blue come November, there's no way they're going to do that. Enough of them are going to do that unless Bernie Sanders is the candidate. They'll come back for Bernie, but they're not coming back for another neoliberal. They're not coming back for the Democratic Party establishment. They're fed up with the Democratic Party establishment almost as much as I am.
Well, and I think that, too, there's so many ways that this is experienced or consumed in culture. So you've got this whole thing with people are tired of technocracy. They're tired of the so-called best and the brightest telling the rest of us, you know, how to do stuff, because we all realize now that they really don't know what they're doing. And, you know, just because you went to an Ivy League school doesn't make you the best or the brightest. It just makes you have the richest parents or the biggest student loans, really. I mean, we've been shown that meritocracy, that there's a big problem with meritocracy. I know, when I was growing up,
I'm there.
Okay. It, as a child of the 70s, meritocracy was such a big thing. You know, you work really hard, you know, maybe you get a scholarship, but you go to school and you're going to be on an even footing with everyone else who has a great education. And a great education meant actually learning stuff. It wasn't that, you know, that you went to the most expensive school that you could possibly go to. It was that you studied philosophy and humanities and mathematics and the classics so that when you graduated, you could actually think. Somewhere along the line, that changed.
Well, I think neoliberalism is what's happened to this country in the last four decades, starting with Jimmy Carter. Both parties have become the parties of Wall Street. There's no opposition party anymore. That's what Bernie Sanders is actually presenting, and that's why he represents an existential threat to the party establishment. They don't want him. This is a very, very tough situation we're in. The party establishment will do everything they can to defeat Bernie Sanders. And what that means is Donald Trump's going to get reelected as a result. If Bernie Sanders is not the nominee, and I'll bet $1,000, I've offered this bet up to dozens of people, and nobody's taken me up on this bet. Barring a recession, barring a market crash, I will bet $1,000 that if Bernie Sanders, up to $1,000, if Bernie Sanders is not the nominee, Trump gets reelected. And nobody's taken me up on that bet. And one more point about this, about this claim that I'm making.
Because people like, I agree. That's easy to see. I think that's easy for a lot of people to see. What's the second one?
It is. I've asked. This is Twitter, so whether they get the message or not, there's only one polling analyst I've asked who I know got this message, and none of them have disagreed with me. Rachel Bitcoffer, she's on MSNBC once in a while. She's a polling analyst who allows private messaging. So I'm right in her private message on Twitter, showing her, making this claim and saying, and asking her, where am I wrong? How is this conclusion wrong, that under current economic conditions, with the economic winds at the president's back, how is anyone but Bernie Sanders going to get elected? How can anyone else? In other words, Bernie's the only one who can. Am I wrong about that? No answer. I've asked Steve Kornacki. I've asked Nate Silver. I've asked Brian Schaffner. There's Michael, oh boy, I can't think of his last name. Not Blumenthal is a pollster, polling analyst. I've asked 7 polling analysts, where am I wrong with this conclusion? And none of them come back to say, well, you're not taking into account such and such. I'm right. We are right about this. And if the economy, if the stock market crashes, then all bets are off. Because at that point, Buttigieg could defeat Donald Trump. That, the only thing Trump really has going for him is a strong economy, given what a disgusting and revolting plutocrat he is. All he'll have left if the stock market crashes is his racist and xenophobic supporters.
How far do you think the party establishment would go to, or just the establishment in general, how far do you think they would go to prevent Bernie Sanders from being the nominee or being elected in a general election or taking power? I mean, how entrenched do you think this is?
I think if I had to put money down right now, as much as obviously I'm a supporter of Bernie Sanders and I get all this, if I had to put money down right now, I think they will do everything they can. I think they'd rather have – someone just published an essay about this, a college professor in Common Dreams just yesterday. These people would rather have Trump in the White House than Bernie Sanders. I'm talking about people like Obama, people like Tom Perez, certainly the Wall Street funders of the Democratic Party, the major funders, all the major funders of the Democratic Party would rather have Trump in the White House. CNN, I think, would rather have Trump in the White House. And it was pretty clear they don't care how much they're damaging Sanders' candidacy by asking him leading questions. The cry on during the debate Tuesday night included how will Sanders spending not bankrupt the country or something like that. They don't even understand modern money. These are either that was a dishonest cry-on or it was an ignorant cry-on, because the United States cannot go bankrupt. It just can't, because we're not on a gold standard. So you can always print money. You can always pay for anything and everything you need. You can have your war and your Medicare for all, too. It means we'll have huge deficits and huge debts, but that doesn't matter.
Let me just quote somebody real quick. Mm-hmm.
Dick Cheney, when they were not paying for their wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Cheney said, Ronald Reagan taught us deficits do not matter. So some of these elites get it. They know the size of the debt and the size of the deficits don't matter.
Mm-hmm. And you don't have to be a maximalist on that, just to the bankruptcy thing, that not bankrupting a country, just by definition, you don't have to be an MMT maximalist, like, you know, all the way, to see that that's complete crap. You know, the country's not going to go splat. If they were going to go splat, they would go splat over the trillions of dollars that have been spent on tax cuts for the wealthy, or the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, or, you know,
and all
the money that's and the money that's just stolen in fraudulent government contracting, which is a whole other thing. But, you know, Obama came out at the end of last year. This was here's a story in Salon from November 27. Obama privately vowed to intervene in primary to stop Bernie Sanders from winning nomination. A vow, like,
right.
Like,
right.
You know,
he's
gonna
get
I will
Trump
do
re-elected.
This.
He is going. First of all, it's his legacy that Trump is in the White House. That's part of his legacy. If he had been the progressive he campaigned as, if he had gotten people Medicare for all, if he had gotten a higher minimum wage, if he had fought for the stuff he campaigned on, if he had governed as a progressive instead of the moderate Republican he admitted he governed as,
then Trump would not have been elected, would not have won the, you know, they would have trusted the status quo that was progressive. But the status quo that was the Obama Clinton presidency, the people just said, no, I'm sick of this. These are empty promises. These are, we got nothing from Obama. So I am convinced, again, Perez, Obama, these elites would rather have Trump than Bernie Sanders. And if Obama does interfere, that's exactly what they're going to do. And just one more point, I'm not sure I made it a few minutes ago. If I had to bet right now, even though I support Bernie and I think Bernie should be the nominee and could defeat Trump, but if I, given all the forces arrayed against Bernie in the media, in the establishment, my sense is that they're going to nominate someone who can't beat Trump, and Trump will win re-election. If I had to bet money right now, I would say Trump will be re-elected. Because, not because Bernie can't beat him, but because the Democratic Party establishment won't let Bernie win the nomination.
Well, I'll let you in on a little just, you know, kind of hitch in my giddy up that happened not too long ago. Remember when AOC, when Bernie was doing the rally with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and it was their first time together, and they were, you know, it was kind of this cotillion, you know, like a coming out, like, here, we're a campaign now, we're doing this thing
in New York.
In New York, exactly. I was watching that, and the whole thing was super moving, first of all. But out of nowhere, just out of left field, I got hit with this emotion and was crying because I was like, they're not going to let this happen. It was just this feeling of knowing, out of nowhere, all of a sudden, it was just, there's no way in hell that they, that the establishment, that they're going to let this happen. This is too... And this is my subconscious talking to me. This is me, you know, having a conversation with all of my fears and hopes and everything at the same time. But, you know, I just all of a sudden got this, you know, Robert Kennedy vibe. You know, I got this like, holy shit, this is exactly the kind of person that they would pull out all the stops to stop.
Yeah, I wish I could disagree with that. I wish I could formulate a rationalization that, well, that just won't happen, but I can't. I think that's a very real fear, and it's actually one of the reasons why you don't want a vice presidential nominee like Warren, because, you know, you could easily end up with President Sanders finding himself committing suicide, or however they will, you know, frame their,
you make a good
murder.
Point. You make a good point. You don't want to make, you don't want the VP to be a more attractive president than to the establishment, to the people who might be allied with his CIA. Don't give them the VP that they want. And in the last couple of minutes, and I want to let you know too that I signed up on Blog Talk Radio for 90 minutes, and they'll cut me off in 90 seconds, as they just told me in my headset. Tell me where to go from here. What are we going to do?
If every one of Bernie Sanders supporters come out and say, I'm Bernie or bust, every one of them across the country let the Democratic Party know in no uncertain terms that they're not blue no matter who. They will vote for the Green Party candidate or the Socialist Party candidate, and that's Bernie or bust this time around. You go to I got to remember the website. Go to BernieOrBust2020.us and take the pledge. Take the pledge. And send a message to the Democratic Party. We are not on board with neoliberalism. If Bernie's not the nominee, screw you guys, I'm going home. You might be bluffing, some 10% did last time, but send that message. Take the Bernie Bluff pledge and send the message.
And we heard it all here. Go follow Bernie or Bust on Twitter. Go take that pledge. I'm getting ready to get cut off. So thank you so much, Victor. This was a lot of fun, and I needed to talk to you. I've been kind of bummed out. All right. We'll do it again real soon.
Sounds good.
I don't know why that came in so loud, but it did. Hope you enjoyed that. If you're still listening, thank you so much. Thank you so much for, just doing the thing and keeping Progressive News Network in your heart. It means so much to me. It actually does. We'll talk to you next time. See us on Sunday. Great show. Bye.